is Mark Frauenfelder for Boing Boing. The new comic book Testament, published by Vertigo DC, depicts a near future in which people in the United States are required by law to have an RFID tracking chip implanted in their arm. So far in Testament, which has two issues out, the storyline is focused on a family that used to live in France, where RFID chips weren't routinely implanted at birth. Now the parents have to decide whether or not to give their son Jake, who is of draft age, the implant. The problem is that Jake's father is one of the main developers of the implants, and he knows that the technology is being used for some dark purposes by the government. He realizes he's faced with sacrificing his son. Another storyline is woven through Testament. It's from the Old Testament, and it's about Abraham being asked to sacrifice his son's life. It's a story that parallels the ethical choice Jake's father faces. The writer of Testament is my good friend Douglas Rushkoff, an author and media theorist who has written many nonfiction books, two novels, one graphic novel. You can visit his website by going to rushkoff.com. I'm always thrilled when Douglas visits me from New York, because we stay up late into the night talking. Douglas is interested in everything, and his observations about even the most seemingly mundane things become fascinating when he turns conventional ideas about them upside down. I interviewed Doug a couple of days ago about Testament. Here it is. Testament is about what you've called the essential mythic battle underlying Western civilization, and I really like that. Maybe you could tell me, what is the battle and what's at stake?
I guess most easily it's about whether we accept the given circumstances of our world as pre-existing conditions that can't be changed and can only really be accepted and worked with, or whether we believe that reality is fundamentally in our own hands and capable of being written, rewritten, and evolved by people. You know, that's really the main story of Torah, which is the first five books of the Bible. It's these people who are down in Egypt, you know, worshiping these gods who kind of made everything and are responsible for everything, and who are so busy, bowing down to their icons, whether it's Pharaoh or the various, you know, hosts of gods that, that he hangs out with, any other kind of cultural value of the time. They're so busy looking up to that and thinking about the afterlife. You know, the Egyptian religion was really all about what happens after you die.
Mm-hmm.
That they ignored the, you know, terrible injustices that were going on in everyday life. I mean, this was a society with, you know, slaves and, you know, terrible cruelty, and it was a very harsh place. So, you know, these Israelites run out to the desert and liberate themselves from all of these terrible gods. That's really what the plagues are about in the Torah, where they desecrate each one of the Egyptian gods one by one and go out into the desert. And what do? Is, you know, they write their own laws. That's Moses sits down with his brother-in-law and develops really the first kind of system of government that was going to be explicitly developed by people. And, you know, the story means that, you know, you have to sort of smash your idols. You have to, you know, break free of your cultural gods and these fixed templates of reality. You have to stop thinking that reality is just something you have to bear with, and instead see it as something that's not only open to hacking, but that it's your obligation as a living human being to assist in the unfolding and evolution of our little dimension as best as possible.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that, you know, you've got these kind of god demons, and I think they're Moloch and Astarte. Is that how you pronounce?
Yeah, they're the first two we meet. Yeah,
and they're kind of sort of overseeing both the biblical and the modern events that are unfolding in the story,
almost as if both the biblical and the modern events are happening at the same time.
Well, as far as the gods are concerned, they are. You know, what I've done is I've put sequential action, and that's the sort of the biblical stories and modern counterparts or allegories to those stories. I've put all of that action inside the frames, you know, in the panels of a comic book.
Mm-hmm.
So they move like any sequential narrative in a really linear way. And then outside the panels is where these gods, like Malach and Astarte, or, you know, eventually we have a biblical equivalent of those gods in Melchizedek and Elijah sort of plays one of the good guy gods, and eventually Krishna comes in there. But they exist outside the frames as if to say they're living in a different kind of time. They're
mm-hmm.
living in eternal time. And they can't really interfere so much. You know, if they want to try to enter a frame, like, you know, Malach might shove his hand inside a frame, but it'll only show up within that frame as, like, fire at the top of a volcano.
Uh-huh.
So they can affect things, you know, elementally, but they can't just step in because they are, you know, on a sort of different dimensional order. So the idea there is that these gods kind of exist throughout time. They take different forms, but they are sort of timeless representations of different kinds of, you know, human emotions and longings and energies, whereas people, you know, live sequentially. So to the gods, you know, the fact that the story's happening now and the story's happening in some kind of Bible time doesn't really mean anything different. It's all the same story.
Mm-hmm. I love the way that you have Moloch and Astarte literally outside the frames of the, you know, the sequential action. That's a really cool way to do it, which, you know, makes me wonder how do you work with the artist on getting this kind of stuff across? Is, you know, what's your relationship like with the artist? And the art's really cool too.
Yeah, the art is cool. I mean, the relationship may not be the ideal one, in that, you know, I'd love to be over in, you know, Scotland or wherever, you know, down the lane from this guy.
And, oh, that's where he is? He's in Scotland, actually?
Yeah, and get together over beers and talk about this stuff. But our relationship is somewhat dictated by the DC process. You know, and DC has I should be happy about it, I guess. DC has a writer's emphasis. So it really is a matter of a sequence of events where, you know, I come up with the story and submit the outline, and the editor looks at it and says their comments, and then I write the script, and then a rewrite or a polish of that script until it's just right, and then it goes, you know, from me to a layout artist, to then to Liam, then to the colorist. So it all sort of moves down the pike in one direction,
mm-hmm.
and it's not that often that Liam can then sort of send ideas back up the pike to me, because, you know, it's sort of not in the timeline of the way the production worked. But what I'm trying to do is be as specific as I need to be for the sort of relationship of Mythos to Chronos to work out the way I want it to.
Mm-hmm.
There's a relationship of sort of meta story to real character story. So that has to happen in certain ways, and I got to make sure I have all my ducks in a row in terms of sort of, you know, biblical scholarship, or you know, I need to tell the Bible story the way I really need it to be told, and I need my modern characters to convey, you know, what's realistic, given that I know what they have to do later more
mm-hmm.
than anybody else. But other than that, I really try to make it more that I'm writing a screenplay, and then the artist is the director cinematographer. I really like the idea of him lining up the shots and thinking of how that should go.
Yeah, and I think he does a good job. You know, like the 2-page spread on in Testament in the opening, where the title is, you know, where you have Abraham, and then it kind of, you know, turns into to Jake's father, the nanotech scientist, you know.
Right. I mean, it's interesting. On the first couple of issues, I even you know, I drew little stick-figure diagrams of how that should be. You know, so I would show, like, Moloch in his hand going through a frame and turning into flame or turning into an RFID tag installer, because it's really hard to describe verbally exactly what that means.
Mm-hmm.
A few issues, I kind of do that stuff. And then by the next few issues, Liam is thinking of his own, you know, extremely clever ways of transmitting those same ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And on some level, it's a matter of getting the editors to trust that a script is done enough for the next guy to take it. Because I'm trying now to sort of make the scripts a little more primitive, so they're like half-baked or three-quarter-baked, which then gives Liam more of a chance to come up with more novel ways of representing stuff visually than I could, because I'm not really the visual person here.
Yeah. One thing that I think is interesting in, you know, the way you have the modern stories paralleling the stories from the Old Testament is that, you know, in the first issue, which is, I'll probably mispronounce it, Akedah?
Yeah, it depends on how you're... Yeah, Akedah.
Akedah. Abraham's asked to, is challenged with having to sacrifice his son. And, you know, in the modern story, the father is faced with whether or not he should sacrifice his son in a slightly different way. But it almost seems that they take different paths. It seems to me that, and maybe I'm wrong, but Abraham, you know, would actually go ahead and sacrifice his son, but somebody, you know, he was willing to actually kill his son until someone told him not to. But in the other case, you know, the father makes his own decision. Are you showing that, you know, this is demonstrating that people do have free will and they can change these events that happen over and over again?
In a way, I mean, it's a hint at it. I mean, you still see the good God's hand coming in, you know, sort of pushing the modern guy's hand away.
Mm-hmm.
So there's still a godlike force, or even a almost a Jewish memory in this guy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the obvious point of the parallel is to say that, you know, what the Bible is telling us is that sacrificing your kids is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Sacrificing your kids to any ideal or God, you know, whether you're sacrificing them to the god Moloch because you're scared of not getting a harvest the next year, or whether you're sacrificing them, you know, to the god Exxon because you're scared of not getting oil the next year. You know, it's the same thing. We're sending off our kids to the slaughter, and we can't quite see the bigger picture. So, you know, it's a good, easy, clear way to start the series and show how there are these parallels going on. But in modern life, we don't really experience things as, we don't experience our conscience, say, as a god outside of ourselves speaking to us. You know,
mm-hmm.
like before we developed, speech and text and all what we have today, you know, people really did walk around thinking that they were hearing things. You know, people were what we'd call schizophrenic. They did hear God. You know,
mm-hmm.
They didn't understand that inner voices were actually just inner voices bubbling up. They thought of them as other entities. So, you know, if you're gonna really come up with modern parallels to what's going on in the Bible, you're not going to have, you know, the burning bush talking to you in the middle of the desert. You're going to have, you know, different kinds of oracles and different kinds of kind of transcendent experiences.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
I mean, the real idea here is, you know, the thing that always gets me so ticked off is how, you know, fundamentalists, whether it's, you know, fundamentalist Christians, fundamentalist Jews, you know, tend to promote this idea that the reason we should believe in the Bible is because it really happened. You know, that it happened at some moment in history.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm trying to say is that really static view, that historical view of the Bible is actually what prevents those people from applying the Bible's insights to their current situation. these people are not really embracing Bible and Torah because they're not getting that the Bible didn't happen at some moment in history. The Bible is happening in every moment of your life. You are Cain, you are Moses, you are Jacob, struggling with these same things. And until you accept that this is a description of a dynamic that's a kind of eternal dynamic, until you do that, you can't even start to wrestle with the kinds of ideas that are in there.
Mm-hmm.
When you're using, you know, the Torah or the Bible instead to, you know, justify a war or to justify certain, you know, a status of nation states and who belongs where, then you're using it as kind of almost a real estate document. And that really diminishes the allegorical value of this stuff. And this is the really the most magical, powerful set of myths available to us. I mean, you know, Crowley and all Madame Blavatsky, all those people, yeah, great, God bless them. But if you really want to get down to the source code, you know, all you have to do is pick up a Bible. I mean, the Gideons put it in the hotel drawer. I mean, they're everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
They're so powerful, and yet they're ignored by the kinds of people who I think could actually use this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I turned to comics, because the kinds of people who I think can really benefit from understanding Bible and the kind of people who could really tap into its energy are really the least likely to pick one up.
Mm-hmm. What is it that you find so great about writing for comics? I mean, you've written for TV and print and online, so you kind of have, you know it, what it's like to write in all these different media. What's special about comics?
I mean, for me, what's special about comics is it's the first medium that really let me tell the story and comment on the story at the same time in a really organic way. In other words, I've tried to do it with novels where I'll put footnotes in the novel or have multiple narrators or, you know, try all these sort of literary devices to both do something, comment on the thing, or have multiple perspectives on the thing, or have a story happening in more than one time. And it's like, duh, sequential narrative is just the ideal form in which to do, something where you're communicating really in the gap more than you are in the stuff. In other words, it's not the actual panels as much as the space between the panels where the real magic is occurring. And it's kind of, comics are this precursor to interactive media, and in some ways still the most interactive media out there. You know, it's like interactive narrative hasn't quite been figured out. I'm supposed to be teaching this stuff at NYU, and no one really knows how interactive narrative is going to work, other than, you know, some video games that we've got going now. So comics really feels like a place. It's sort of the last edge of the sort of the literary era, and the precursor to whatever this, you know, highly visual, computerized interactive era is going to be. So it's sort of, for me, it's a sweet spot. But the attraction is being able to do more than one thing at a time, to have a story and a meta story, to work sequentially from panel to panel, page to page, issue to issue, meaning it's much more like television in that way than it is like a movie. It's not just this thing with a beginning, middle, and an end. It's
mm-hmm.
a universe that you get to create sort of a beat at a time. You stay with people. You know, you're operating on this sort of liminal level in the back of people's heads the whole month until the next issue comes out. That's some really valuable psychic territory to be inhabiting.
Yeah.
It's unlike anything I've gotten to do in any other medium.
I think also it's really fortunate that you are doing this with DC rather than an independent publisher that doesn't really care that much about a schedule. Because like you said, it comes out, you know, reliably once a month, and that gives you an experience that you can't get from, you know, say like a Hernandez, like a Love and Rockets comic, which comes out maybe every 6 months or a year, whenever those guys finish it. And it's also different from if, you know, you wrote a, you know, 300-page graphic novel that you just read, you know, at once. It's a you get a completely different experience
exactly.
getting part of it once a month.
It's coming at people a lot more in the fashion that these stories came at people, you know, 2,000 years ago. You know, this is, or us out at 2,000, 2,500. I mean, they would go once a week or twice a week and hear the next installment of the story, the next Parsha. You know, and that's, it's sort of the original episodic delivery of a long narrative. So, it's definitely, you know, it's definitely consonant with the values of the original storytellers too.
Yeah, it gives you time to reflect, and a month seems like a good time. Because you,
totally, yeah.
Well, Douglas, thanks a lot for talking with me.
Well, thanks for thinking to include me in this.
Yeah. I'm really enjoying it a lot, and I'm, you know, looking forward to the third issue, which should be coming out pretty soon.
I know. It's like rapid. Now I'm finally at the place where it's like, oh my gosh, I really have to keep up.
Uh-huh.
Once it started, it's once a month is faster than you think.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. It is a lot. And yeah, I mean, you're obviously putting a ton of work into each story, so I know you're busy with it.
Yeah.
All right, well, thanks a lot, Douglas.
Hey, Doug.